From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul.
You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. As we enter the 71st year since the hallmark Supreme Court ruling, Brown versus the Board of Education, America is coming into another uncertain era around education.
Today, as the Department of Education is giving schools and universities 2 weeks to eliminate diversity initiatives or risk losing federal funding.
There is an awful lot of fear and uncertainty right now for parents, for children, and for all of you and those you represent. President Trump and his bootlickers are tearing down, even as we speak, the U.S. Department of Education from inside.
Well, around the country now, schools from kindergarten to college are beginning to scrub their websites and change programming in response to President Trump's policies against diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. The president signing executive orders banning diversity practices across the federal government and educational institutions. Many private companies also reversing course on their DEI-related programs.
Recent headlines around DEI and the future of funding for the Department of Education has left some of our country excited and others worried. So the Dialogue team wanted to take a look back 71 years to the time when the Supreme Court ruled separate was not equal, to see what's changed, what hasn't, and the potential outcomes of this new administration. The University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign has organized a Brown v. Board series ranging from unfinished promises to the final event, a fireside chat. Their recent fireside chat on March 6th was an event about local change agents linked to this significant history. Dr. Rod Wyatt, the assistant chancellor of pre-K through 12 at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, helped spearhead this event.
And I think sometimes it's probably lost on far too many of us that they put their own safety on the line during a time where radical motivated violence was often superseded the rule of law. And they did so in the name of a better life for their children and for the community and for generations to come. So let's remember that Brown versus the Board is an abbreviation because it takes more than a moment to cite the complete list of plaintiffs in this landmark case. Darlene Brown, Lena Carper, Sadie Emanuel, Marguerite Emerson, Sherma Fleming, Zelma Henderson, Shirley Hodson, Maude Lofton, Alma Lewis, Ina Richardson, Vivian Scales, and Lucinda Todd versus the Board of Education of Dubuque, Kansas.
We'll be hearing more from him later, and the Fireside Chat event's moderator, alum and author, Dr. Marley Bunch.
We always think about Brown as being kind of this moment of an equal playing field for students. But really, we still have yet to live up to the dream of Brown and the hope of Brown of equal access.
Two of the featured speakers were cousins, Angela Rivers and Dr. Barbara Suggs Mason. They were born and raised in Urbana-Champaign. Rivers spent her adult life educating through art and museum work in Chicago. She helped create the African American Heritage Trail here in Champaign County. Dr. Suggs was a public school educator in Illinois for over 37 years and is now the co-chair on the African American Heritage Trail. I sat down with them to learn more about their life growing up after the monumental court decision and how it impacted the local Black community.
We start with Dr. Suggs explaining the experience of being a Black student in Champaign-Urbana schools after the Brown v. Board decision.
I would say the immediate effects of Brown versus the Board of Education really didn't take effect here until the 60s. So it was really 12, 13 years after Brown versus the Board of Education that we really began to look at the schools in terms of the desegregation. Growing up here, there were the elementary schools in the community. The segregation was de facto segregation, meaning they were neighborhood schools. And if you lived in a neighborhood that you were assigned by boarders to a particular school, you might have gone to an integrated elementary school. It really just depended. So Marquette School, Gregory School, and I believe Lincoln School were schools that had African Americans attending them. I attended Marquette. My father attended Marquette in the 30s. And so that was one experience that you might have. The other was if you lived in the North End and certain boundaries and you were African American, you attended first Lawhead School, which was torn down probably in the 70s, but closed in 1951. That time, the school district built Booker T. Washington Elementary School. 1952, it opened. And after, I believe, Booker T. Washington went up to the fifth grade, there was another school that doesn't get talked about too much, and that was Willard School. And Willard School was right off of Fifth Street. If you know where Salem Baptist Church is, there's a parking lot in the back of the church, and that's where Willard School was. And it also had a black principal, I believe Mr. McMurray. And Booker T. Washington at that time, the principal was Odelia Wesley. And those were primarily segregated schools. The population, I actually talked to some people who went to Booker T. Washington. Almost all of the teachers were African-American, and with the exception of maybe two or three students who were assigned to probably special education classes, it was a totally African-American population. And so the interesting thing about attending Marquette, I started there in kindergarten and went all the way through sixth grade, is I have a picture of my kindergarten class. And in that kindergarten class, there were two African-American students, myself and Wanjel Carter. And by the time I got to sixth grade, and I have a picture of my sixth grade class, there were only two white students left at the school. The rest of the class was African-American. So you can see that the school resegregated over that period of time. And as I said, Gregory School was one of the schools, and Lincoln, I believe, was the other, that were integrated by virtue of the fact that African American families lived within the boundaries of that school.
Angela Rivers recalled going to school with cautious parents and classmates.
Well, you're growing up, you see by kind of like example, and it's also explained to you so that you have a basic understanding of how to maneuver the environment. Our family let us know that we were as good as anybody else, so that they couldn't keep us from, you know, being served or we, but you could go places, you be nice, you be quiet, you don't be subservient, you just be polite. And you had these, like they could say, little microaggressions that would happen. But, you know, I enjoyed my childhood because there was so much that we could do and so much we did do. You know, we went exploring. We were allowed to go exploring. We explored up and down the train tracks, sometimes walking as far as down to Curtis Road along the train tracks and stuff, because, you know, you had all the stuff that was with the trains, you know, the depots. And then you had the creeks and these little mini seasonal lakes. We'd ride our bicycles, you know, in the community. Then we would play. We had a big area that was in front of our house that was used as a playground traditionally by African Americans since the early 1900s. But the little mini aggressions was always there, you know. Our parents kept a very close eye on us. They gave us instructions what we should and shouldn't do. And if we did it, we got punished for it. You know, because basically, when you look back on it, a lot of it had to do with ensuring that we were safe. Because in the community, in the neighborhood, it was a working class, lower middle class neighborhood overall. And you had a lot of aggressive people, a lot of prejudiced people that lived mm-hmm. in the neighborhood, you know, that surrounded us. So we had to, you know, always be aware of that.
And Rivers noted that the aggressions were not only confined to classmates. She related a painful experience with a white teacher.
It was in fourth grade, and it was a science project, and I chose dinosaurs for my science project. At the time, my mother was working for Our Wonderful World that was here in Champaign. It was an encyclopedia, and she worked as an illustrator with Our Wonderful World. So we had a set of Our Wonderful World encyclopedias. And of course, my father had bought a second set as well. But I would research all of this stuff reading, and I would take the little plastic dinosaurs and paint them so they'd look realistic as to what back then they thought realistic dinosaurs looked like. And set up this whole little diorama. I even made a volcano that erupted.
It erupted.
Yeah, I made it so that it would erupt and took it to school for the project. And a teacher gave me an F. And she gave me the F because she said that there was no way possible that I could have done this by myself. And I could have researched and read all that material. So my mother came up to school and read her the riot act, demanded to see the principal, and told her that she would go to the school board meeting as well. And the principal had the teacher apologize and kind of back off, you know, so they knew not to mess with us. This microaggression, you just didn't arbitrarily mess with children, mess with us.
Mm-hmm.
All the parents in our little enclave was pretty much like my mother. They didn't take that. You know, they wouldn't allow that to happen to their children.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were also kind of taught the old-fashioned thing, you know, you don't start a fight, but you finish it. So if somebody picked on you in the playground, you finish it. You make sure that they understand never to mess with you again. You know, so that when we would start school year was very interesting because every year, you know, you had to start by laying the groundwork, you know, socially laying the groundwork of where you stand with the other students. And, you know, make sure the bullies understand they don't mess with you, you know, so that you would have a nice year.
Once they were old enough for high school, Dr. Barbara Suggs Mason says she had an epiphany about her education.
In terms of education, I would say I probably didn't notice it as much as when I finally got to junior high, because the junior highs, Edison is where I attended, and Champaign High School, which became Champaign Central High School, everybody went there. So it was a mixed group of students racially who attended those schools. But what I did experience was I found out when I went to Edison and I was placed in, for want of a better term, a gifted class, I realized how much I had not been taught at Marquette, particularly in math and science. And what some individuals who I know attended Booker T. Washington felt that they did not have all of the materials that they had. They had some great teachers, African-American teachers who lived in the community, went to church in the community, and took a really strong interest in making sure that those students achieved. All of them say that the teachers had high expectations for them. And that you couldn't get away with much because your teacher may have gone to the same church that you went to, or they saw your mom in the grocery store. They didn't mind coming by the house to see what was going on with you and to have those conversations with parents.
Dr. Marley Bunch is an interdisciplinary educator, scholar, and author. She was the moderator at the UIUC Brown v. Board Fireside Chat. Her book, Unlearning the Hush, focuses on Black female educators in Mississippi from 1954 to 1970 and the impact that desegregation had on their lives and careers. I spoke with her about the role Black female educators play in schools, then and now.
Brown v. Board happened in 1954, and the ruling was that schools could not legally be segregated any longer. We know that in Mississippi, desegregation didn't actually occur until 1970 in Hattiesburg, so 16 years later. So what was interesting when I spoke to my participants was to hear what happened in that 16 years when people were trying to stave off and prevent desegregation from occurring. And so what I really wanted to understand was, how did they uplift students and the community, and what pedagogy and practices did they use in the classroom to ensure that their students were leaving the classroom and entering a very racialized world, and they were ready to kind of carry forward the efforts of the civil rights movement at that time. The themes that emerged were things like the importance of mentorship and making sure that students and families, I would say I would include, had mentorship throughout that time period, creative curriculum, learning about Black history, the power of, you know, kind of this triad of the community, the school, and the church. And I think those three things really helped to support students, even though we were at that time, they were functioning in Jim Crow South in this very violent, segregated time. Teachers were able to kind of circumvent some of those disparities that were happening through the relationships that they forged with students and the community at large.
Black women have often been silent leaders throughout American history. Can you talk a bit more about this historical context of Black women in the classrooms and how integral it really has been for where American education is today?
Yeah, I would actually say silent leaders and also not silent leaders, right? When I think about kind of the history of strong leaders, I think about somebody like a Fannie Lou Hamer, Mary McLeod Bethune, who all did these really progressive things for the community and for education and equality. I think about Mrs. Barbara Ross. She is the eldest living Black educator from Topeka, Kansas, who taught during Brown v. Board. And we were able to bear witness to her story. She's 99 years old. She, just like all of these women, did whatever was necessary to make sure that students felt valued and seen in the classroom. And then in addition to that, were academically prepared. And so I think that that history just is so nicely leads into the story of Dr. Suggs and Miss Rivers, and that the way that they carry forward that work that had been done historically by all of these incredible women who kind of paved the way. We also know there were 80,000 Black educators across 17 Southern states prior to Brown v. Board in 1954. And after Brown v. Board, that number fell to below 40,000. And so we know that as a result of that decision, the reality of that is we had a loss of Black educators. Many were fired, demoted, went from teaching one grade, being asked to teach a grade that they hadn't taught previously, or principals, for example, are now in the role of a janitor. So Brown v. Board did harm when it came to Black educators in the classroom and in those spaces. We also know that prior to desegregation, those spaces were Black spaces. We don't see that so much today, but to be able to have a Black-only space, that was, I would say, one of the protections offered to students.
As a child, in the wake of Brown v. Board, and then a Black educator herself, Dr. Suggs echoed those sentiments when she spoke with me about her experience.
So when I look at the scores, and I see single digits for African-American children, my heart cries. It really does, because we have to better prepare our kids. We have to have high expectations, but then we also have to provide those supports for families, for children within the school system and outside within the community. What this study says is we put black and white kids together in a classroom side by side, but it hasn't impacted the achievement of African American students. And when I hear about some of the problems that African American students had in integrating schools, in not feeling fully accepted by teachers back in those days, I'm not going to speak about now, but in those days, not being fully accepted by teachers, teachers not having expectations for their students. Mm. You do have to wonder sometimes if back when Booker T. Washington was a predominantly black school, in some ways were kids getting more of what they needed. Mm-hmm. That's always a question with desegregation. What are we gaining? What are we losing? And is it balancing out? And I think that's a question we still struggle with today.
Dr. Suggs Mason cited the lack of black teachers since schools integrated and the toll it's taking on African American students.
When I grew up in this community, black teachers, I always say, were the intellectual leaders of this community. They had wisdom. They showed they cared. When I was in Marquette School, I had one African-American teacher the whole time I was there, Mary Frances Walden. I had her for third grade and I had her for fourth grade. And research says that if African-American students can have at least one black teacher by the time they're in third grade, the research shows that they're able to complete high school, probably go on to college, have limited incidents in terms of behavior, and they are academically able to achieve. So if I could say anything, I just want to encourage that we need more African-American teachers in our school, not less. That's something that in integration, we lost a lot of our African-American teachers. When I was doing some research on this, and I don't know that this is necessarily true, but the feeling was that some of the best teachers at Booker T. Washington School got moved to white schools. But I knew those ladies. I knew those men. I went to church with them. I went to school with their kids. And I'm proud to say they were my role models in what can be achieved as an African-American educator.
Ain't gonna let nobody load it. Turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let nobody load it. Turn me round, keep on a walking, keep on a talking, marching up to freedom land. Ain't gonna let segregation load it. Turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. Ain't gonna let segregation load it. Turn me round, keep on a walking, keep on a talking, marching up to freedom land.
The desegregation of public schools over the last 71 years hasn't been fully successful or linear. In July of 2022, a U.S. Government and Accountability Office report found that over 30% of students, that's around 18.5 million in the nation, attended schools where 75% or more of the student body was the same race or ethnicity. Champaign Unit 4 schools aren't an outlier to this, which resulted in parents taking the issue to the courts in the late 90s. Dr. Suggs brings up how this was a landmark case within its own right for local Champaign schools, and Dr. Bunch adds to the national context of this conversation.
Okay, so the initial complaint was filed with the Office of Civil Rights in May and June of 1996. And in 1998, the school district entered into a resolution with the Office of Civil Rights resolving the issues and the initial complaints. However, the plaintiffs did not agree that it had been successful. And so following that, in October of 2000, they filed a suit with the U.S. District Court of the Central Districts of Illinois against Unit 4. And in January of 2002, they approved a second revised consent decree. and this involved schools of choice, and it expired in 2009. In looking at a report that came out in 2016 on school integration across the country, one of the districts they looked at was Unit 4. And what they indicated was, Champaign has implemented a successful plan to desegregate schools, first instituted in response to litigation and now continued voluntarily. However, persistent struggles to address disparities in academic offerings, school discipline, and perceptions of school climate for students of color has resulted in large academic achievement gaps across both race and socioeconomic status. And as an educator and as a member of the community and as someone who grew up here, that is a real concern. It's a concern because we are losing generations of African-American students by not addressing their academic progress and the disparity and the gap between African-American students and white students in the community. And I think that this is something that Unit 4 and probably District 116 have struggled with.
We do see a resegregation in classrooms today, and I think you can see it in any city, right? You think about kind of a dividing line in a city that happened because of redlining or blockbusting. And then after that, school boundaries were drawn. And all of those things are built out of the system, built out of this idea of, now that schools have desegregated, how can we ensure that we keep our cities kind of zoned so that there's a Black side of the city and there's a white side of the city? And those schools then are technically segregated. And so when we think about the way that boundaries are drawn, it does just that, right? It keeps segregation in place. It keeps your lower socioeconomic and usually your schools with Black and Brown students on one side so that the other schools on the other side of the city are the schools that tend to, on paper, have higher test scores, higher socioeconomic, things like that. And I don't know how to dismantle those policies that are happening. We know that with currently what we're up against is that we have to make sure, I would say the number one thing is that we are voting in school board elections, in every election that happens, not just primary elections. I think we also have to be aware of policies that our schools are putting in place. And as parents and families and community members, being aware of that and then challenging those when they are not equitably serving our students. Because we're now in a time and place where we can't rely solely on the administration to do that.
This year, with the new administration, the Department of Education has made many changes. Some of the key points you need to know as of March 22nd are: in early February, the Department of Education sent a letter to public institutions that required the end of diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts in 2 weeks in order to keep their federal funding. They were told to stop using, quote, racial preferences, end quote, in hiring, administration, scholarships, and more. As a result, teacher unions across the country and the American Civil Liberties Union are just a few institutions who have sued the federal government to stop this initiative. To bring this conversation forward locally, the Illinois State Board of Education has made a statement against schools complying with the order, saying, quote, under any banner, discrimination on the basis of race, color, or national origin is, has been, and will continue to be illegal, end quote. As of March 13th, the outcomes for schools who don't comply with ending DEI and where their federal funding stands is still uncertain. And as of March 12th, the Department of Education laid off almost half of its civil rights branches, which is responsible for investigating claims of discrimination and enforcing the Civil Rights Act of 1964. According to the Associated Press, quote, 7 of the civil rights agencies, 12 regional offices were entirely laid off, including busy hubs in New York, Chicago, and Dallas, end quote. The assistant chancellor of pre-K through 12 at UIUC, Dr. Rod Wyatt, who helped in the creation of the Fireside Chat series, spoke about his thoughts around this letter and DEI at the campus event.
So even though we've come a long way since the 1950s, I do believe that even today, we continue to see gaps in achievement and student success. And no, it doesn't strike us quite as overtly as white schools and black schools, but instead we're experiencing vestiges of segregation through issues like the digital divide, which I think you all would agree became very apparent during that period of dealing with COVID-19, when it became one of the things where truly we had to fight against and try to mitigate to make sure that our students were not being further disadvantaged because of the COVID. That is why Brown versus Board remains just as relevant today as it was 70 years ago, because we have not been able to realize the full vision of that landmark decision, especially today when words like diversity, equity, and inclusion, yes, I said it, diversity, equity, and inclusion have been demonized and weaponized in ways that is really disappointing to many of us in the room, and I think many of us across this great nation. It is more important than ever for us to explore what those words really mean, and to be candid about it, who have been some of the primary beneficiaries of DEI work. It's not just in black and brown people. That's what they would have you to believe, but that is far from the truth. It's been transformative across many different people from many different walks of life. In education, what that means is it provides the child the opportunity to succeed, notwithstanding that zip codes are the color of their skin. 70 years ago, the Supreme Court affirmed that this is a fundamental American right. And I would add that it's a fundamental American right that many of our predecessors fought and died for. And so I would even go as far as say it's a fundamental human right. It is essential to our national economic situation and for social well-being. To foster a more welcoming and supportive educational environment benefits everyone within that environment. And we need to make the idea the basis for local, state, national, and policy discussions and decisions.
Over the 71 years since Brown v. Board, though the results haven't been totally successful, America has seen laws and rulings passed that furthered the rights and opportunities of all Americans. Today, the Trump administration has built their legislation on a platform of getting rid of DEI. To quote a line from the letter by the Department of Education, quote, "Educational institutions have toxically indoctrinated students with the false premise that the United States is built upon, quote, systematic and structural racism," end quote, and advanced discriminatory policies and practices. The dialogue team wanted to know that although the Brown v. Board ruling in 1954 established that separate was not equal, this ruling itself went after the systematic laws in place. But how did communities and institutions approach changing the systems of opinion in place around race?
Wow. I'm not sure how to answer that, because I don't know. I'm afraid the answer is I don't know that opinions have shifted, right? When we look at the landscape, current day struggles and issues, I wonder if that's still an area where we've got work to do. You know, the Supreme Court case of Plessy versus Ferguson was in 1896, and that ruling prior to Brown said schools could be separate as long as they were equal. But we know now that schools were not equal. They didn't have equal funding. They didn't have equal resources. And so then the Brown case, as you mentioned, worked to kind of bring about this idea that we could, education was this great equalizer. We could ensure that all students are treated as first-class citizens versus second-class citizens. When we look at today, I don't think that we've been able to get to the place where Black students and educators are viewed in the manner that they should be. And I think clearly race is still a barrier and an issue. And we see that the way in which these systemic barriers carried through from then to now. You know, we see it in redlining. We see it in the way that school boundaries are drawn. We see it in the language and assessments that are used for students, that lack of individual attention and instruction. But unfortunately, I think today teachers don't have the liberty and the time to do a lot of the individualized things that were done previously. And so you have the same systemic barriers and hurdles, but not some of the same remedies that were being offered then. I recently learned about a school in Merriam, Kansas, so not far from Topeka, Kansas, the site of Brown v. Board, not far from where I grew up and live. And there was a school named Madam C.J. Walker School, which is now known as Philadelphia Missionary Baptist Church. But in 1948, there was a family who filed a lawsuit that actually kind of paved the way for the Brown v. Board decision to happen. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. It was known as the Webb versus School District Number 90 lawsuit. And it happened because there was a Black student who was denied entry into one of the schools, and families came together to say, no, this is not okay. And they staged protests known as the Walker Walkouts, where families and students walked out of school in protest to the student being denied entry. And the great thing when I came across it, and they talked about this, really laid the foundation for the Brown v. Board decision to happen. And what I think is cool is I wonder how many stories like that have not been unearthed that we don't know about. But to hear about these spaces in different cities and communities where there was this activism and this strong sense of justice, we're going to do what's right for students and for their education, that really makes me hopeful, because all of that history, I think, reminds us today that we as community members, as teachers, as parents, we can do hard things and we can do what's necessary to ensure that all of our students and children receive the education that they so rightly deserve.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Through fireside chats, oral histories, and creating frameworks like the UNHUSH, African American educators continue to remember that they have always been leaders. And although America is coming into an uncertain era around education, our history remains in our shared life experiences, written and documented. The power of individuals who unearth these stories in themselves and history is prominent. The knowledge and legacy of these educators and mentors we've heard from today highlights the power of the individual and reminds us that it was everyday parents, caring teachers, community efforts, and local heroes that led to the fight for Brown versus the Board of Education to happen and sought the change that they wanted to see. And to that, the Dialogue team says thank you to our local change agents linked to this significant history. Later on in this program, you will hear more about how your child's podcast could be distributed across America on NPR. For Dialogue, I'm Kennedy Vincent.
Oh, yes, it will. Then I go to my brother. And I say, brother, help me please. But he winds up.